Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, Dresden, the London Blitz, rolling thunder, and today, plumes of smoke rising from the Iraqi cities of Baghdad, Mosul, and Kirkuk in an awesome display of firepower from the sky. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld trumpeted the precision of the new improved air campaign, made of weapons, he said, that no one could have dreamed of in prior conflicts. Tonight on Point, the checkered legacy of aerial bombardment, good, bad, ugly, and Baghdad. We begin in Kuwait at the headquarters of the 101st Airborne Division, whose helicopters will spearhead the next phase of invasion. Rick Atkinson is Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent with The Washington Post, author of Crusade, the Untold Story of the Persian Gulf War, and now embedded with the 101st. I asked him what's ahead for the air cavalry.
Well, the 101st Airborne Division is really the arrow that's still in the quiver for the attack planners here in Kuwait. And that's because the 101st is unique among U.S. Army divisions, really among any similar unit in any army, in that they've got 72 Apache attack helicopters. And tonight at 8:45 p.m. local time, which is 12:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the division began crossing into Iraq behind the 3rd Infantry Division, which by now is about 100 miles deep into Iraq. The 3rd Brigade of the 101st is in the process of setting up various gas stations, if you will, because the helicopters need to be refueled before they can begin deep attacks against targets close to Baghdad. And that's what's happening today with 101st.
Rick Atkinson, as you know, there was heavy bombardment of Baghdad and other Iraqi cities today. How does the 101st movement tonight coordinate with that, or is it coordinated with that?
Yeah, it's coordinated because it's all part of one grand master plan. The 101st, again, with their Apaches first and foremost, has the capacity to whittle down some of those Republican Guard divisions that are around Baghdad, the staunchest, along with the Special Republican Guard of the Iraqi military units. So as Baghdad was gnawed away from within through the airstrikes tonight and the Tomahawk missile strikes, soon we'll see a gnawing away from without, and that will be done primarily with Apaches and other air assets that take on the Republican Guard.
Now, if the Marines are 100 miles into Iraq, that leaves another couple of hundred miles to Baghdad. Do the Apaches leapfrog the Marines?
Well, they're not behind the Marines. The Marines are actually to the east with the British. The 101st is behind the 3rd Infantry Division, and they will, in fact, have the capacity to leapfrog over the 3rd Division, which is a mechanized unit. They've got tanks, they've got armored personnel carriers. It's a real juggernaut force that not only acts as the iron tip of the spear in this part of the attack, but also has served as a kind of screening force for the 101st to come up behind them and to get set up.
Now, given the speed of the 3rd Division, we understand that those tanks move along at about 15 miles an hour when all is clear. How far in time from Baghdad might this force be now?
Right now, they're about 100 miles into Iraq. There's a general feeling that, depending on Iraqi resistance, obviously, they're going to be able to go some distance, and then they're going to have to pause because they have to let the logistics tail catch up. All of those armored vehicles, including the M1A2 tanks that they're driving, take a lot of gasoline. It's actually JP-8. It's a kind of jet fuel. Yeah. You've got to allow time for refueling, rearming, although they haven't shot much, so there's not much to rearm yet. And you've got to allow time for the crews to rest. So I think you'll see the 101st get into the fight sometime early next week.
And Rick, at the headquarters where you are, the 101st, have they been closely monitoring the aerial bombardment of Baghdad?
Yes, you can see the pictures that the rest of the country sees through television cameras that are in Baghdad. But they're pretty focused on their own impending fight. I was out with General David Petraeus, who's the commander of the 101st, this afternoon in his Black Hawk helicopter, and we flew out to where the 3rd Brigade, the lead element of the division, was getting ready to cross into Iraq. And we spent a fair amount of time out there watching them organize into their so-called ground attack convoys, the GACs. There's a lot to do. There's a lot to organize. We're talking about, for this portion of the division alone, 2,500 vehicles. Mm. That doesn't give you much time for watching television.
And while that goes on, is there much or any talk about negotiations, back channel with Iraqi commanders, the talk of surrender or defection?
Well, they're assuming that they're going to have to fight their way in. There's also an assumption not only here in the 101st, but I think throughout 5th Corps, which is the parent army organization, that the tough fight is yet to come. They've always presumed that as they got closer to Baghdad and closer to those Republican Guard divisions, that if the Iraqis were going to put up a scrap, it was going to be there, not to mention the difficulties, the perils of fighting in Baghdad itself if it comes to that. So while there are reports that filter in here of some Iraqis surrendering, even whole units surrendering, that's not unexpected because the units that are down closest to the border tend to be conscripts, poorly paid, demoralized. They did the same thing in 1991 in the Persian Gulf War.
So the 101st there is not counting on the so-called shock and awe bombardment to leave Iraqi forces just crumbling before their eyes. They're still counting on going in and doing some fighting here.
Well, they'd be happy to have as much crumbling go on as is possible, but they're fully expecting that there's going to be a substantial force left to fight if they've got the will to fight, and that has always been the big question.
When will you be going forward with this crew, Rick?
We're actually going into Iraq tomorrow, and General Petraeus is going into Iraq tomorrow for the day and then probably coming back here to Camp New Jersey where his communications are better and so on by late afternoon tomorrow. And I think the whole division headquarters will likely begin moving into Iraq maybe Monday. It's a little unclear yet. We have to see how quickly the forces in front move.
Rick Atkinson, thanks for joining us. Be safe.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Washington Post correspondent Rick Atkinson is embedded with the Army's 101st Airborne Division. He spoke with us from Camp New Jersey in Kuwait. The picture is as old as myth of Zeus and thunderbolts, of airborne warriors raining fire from the sky. In modern warfare, air power has become the terrifying overture to war, the tool of choice for weakening enemy infrastructure and resolve. And now, back at home, those terrible fiery skies somehow signal the real start of war. This time, with a blast so arresting, we were told that the beginning would signal the end. But does it work? Do we put too much faith in bombing from the sky? Do air campaigns shock and awe, or strengthen resolve and embitter the bombed? Have you ever been in a city under aerial attack? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Chicago, two esteemed scholars who have written and thought an awful lot about the kind of military situation that the United States finds itself in right now. Robert Pape is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago, specializing in international security affairs. He's author of Bombing to Win, Air Power and Coercion in War. And today in the New York Times, an op-ed piece, Wars Can't Be Won Only from Above. Good evening and welcome, Robert Pape.
Glad to be here.
And also from the University of Chicago, a colleague of Robert Pape's, the esteemed John Mearsheimer, professor at the University of Chicago, specializing also in international security and author of The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. He served in the United States Air Force from 1965 to 1975. Professor John Mearsheimer, it's a delight to have you back. Thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Robert Pape, first to you. You wrote in the Times today about how air power alone is not the secret, but we are not seeing air power alone in this campaign in Iraq, are we? Is this war following the exercise, the use of air power as you would advise it, given your historical study of how it works and doesn't work?
The first few days of the campaign have actually not been air power alone. They've been moderate use of air power, with actually quite rapid and early movement to a ground offensive. What you've just seen in the last few hours, however, with the move to shock and awe, and especially the move to shock and awe today, when the ground forces are still hundreds of miles from Baghdad itself, is actually now we're shifting to a new phase of the war. We're shifting to a phase in the war in which we're relying not on moderate air power and heavy ground power, as we did in the first few days, but now it's more the reverse, where we're using the air instrument. And I think that what we'll be hoping, and it's a reasonable hope, I think, though a futile, likely not to work out, what we're hoping is that the shock and awe of the next few days will solve all our problems.
Give us a little bit of history about how this has worked. Donald Rumsfeld said today that it's a whole new world out there, this is all new. But does shock and awe work? Has it worked historically? Does it bring nations to their knees?
Well, there's some confusion about what is new and what is novel in the shock and awe we're seeing today. The air plan that we're using is actually surprisingly similar to the air plan that we used in the opening days of 1991. In the first few days of 1991, in the first 72 hours, we hit 235 leadership and other strategic targets in and around Baghdad. We used, in those first 3 days, almost 1,500 precision-guided munitions. And in these, in this first day of shock and awe, we're probably right on pace to accomplish, hit about the same number of targets over 3 days, and we'll probably use about twice the number of PGMs that we used, that's precision-guided munitions, that we used in 1991. But the basic logic and the basic targeting is very similar. Leadership is at the core today, just as it was in 1991, and the idea is to try to win by decapitating Saddam's regime, just as it was in 1991.
John Mearsheimer, do you think that this is working? Has it worked? Donald Rumsfeld was asserting today that he sees chaos in the lines of command on the Iraqi side. So is this panning right out?
Well, I think the United States is going to win this one almost no matter what it does. Mm-hmm. This is what I would call an unfair fight. Mm-hmm. This is sort of Bambi versus Godzilla. Mm-hmm. And the only really interesting question is how much resistance Bambi can put up. So this leads me to my second point, which is I think the really interesting question here is what's the best way for Godzilla to win this war? And Godzilla has two weapons at his disposal. One is air power and the other is ground power. And if I were the United States, I would not have turned to massive use of air power, what Bob correctly calls the shock and awe campaign, this early in the game. I would have used the ground forces to roll up all of southern Iraq and then even conquered western and northern Iraq. And I would have come up to the gates of Baghdad with pretty much ground power all alone.
And exactly why would you have avoided the air campaign that we saw launched with such fury today?
Well, I think, number one, it's not likely to have that much effect. It didn't have that much effect in 1991, and it's not likely to have that much effect now. But I think more importantly, for the purposes of winning hearts and minds in the Arab and Islamic world, and even in Europe, and making it look like the United States is a benevolent force, I think it makes good sense not to use massive bombing tactics unless you absolutely have to. And since the ground war is going so well and will continue to go so well, and since there's a reasonable chance that we can cut a deal with the Republican Guard to end this war without having to fight our way into Baghdad, I'd wait to the last possible minute to use the air instrument.
So, Robert Pape, in that case, why do you think the U.S. went ahead? If this is Godzilla versus Bambi and we don't have to use it, why do you think the Pentagon went ahead with such such striking and enormous assault in the last 24 hours?
Well, obviously, only the Pentagon is going to know that, and they're not going to tell us exactly what they, why they changed strategies now, and the best we can do is speculate. I just want to reinforce, however, that if you remember the talk before Shock and Awe, you'll remember the hope that if we could have won without the Shock and Awe, that the points John Mearsheimer made about not having to alienate the Muslim world, about not having to inflict large numbers of casualties from the air, that that would have all been to our benefit.
It would have been to our benefit. We have to take a short break. We're wondering why we didn't stay on that course. We're looking at war from the skies tonight, what works, what doesn't, and how history might inform this war in Iraq. Do we put too much faith in falling bombs? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about war from the skies, what works, what doesn't, and how history might inform this war in Iraq. My guest tonight, two eminent historians and colleagues from the University of Chicago, John Mearsheimer, professor there specializing in international security affairs, and Robert Pape, associate professor of political science at the university, author of Bombing to Win, Air Power and Coercion in War. In an op-ed piece in today's New York Times, wars can't be won only from above. Today, at his news conference at the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld spoke about the character, the quality of the bombing going on so extravagantly filmed today in Baghdad, saying that this is something out of history, this is something new, that this is something that even holds in it, in this bombing, he said, humanity. Let's listen.
Just before coming down, after the air campaign began in earnest about 1 o'clock, I saw some of the images on television, and I heard various commentators expansively comparing what's taking place in Iraq today to some of the more famous bombing campaigns of World War II. There is no comparison. The weapons that are being used today have a degree of precision that no one ever dreamt of in a prior conflict. They didn't exist. And it's not a handful of weapons, it's the overwhelming majority of the weapons that have that precision. The targeting capabilities and the care that goes into targeting to see that the precise targets are struck and that other targets are not struck is as impressive as anything anyone could see. The care that goes into it, the humanity that goes into it.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld today talking about the precision and humanity of today's bombing campaign over Baghdad. These are tough words to fit all into one package. We're talking about war from the skies tonight. You can join the conversation. Was this overkill today or just the ticket? Do air campaigns shock and awe or anger and strengthen resolve on the ground in neighboring nations? And have you ever been under attack from above, from aerial attack? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Robert Pape, I wonder if in some part Donald Rumsfeld was responding to your op-ed piece today when he referred to comparisons to history. He says here that there is no comparison in what is taking place in Iraq today to some of the more famous bombing campaigns of World War II. No comparison. What do you think?
What I think is that this is a misreading of the what is the debate about precision air power today. No one in this debate doubts that accuracy has improved tremendously since World War II. That is when Rumsfeld says that some people or implies some people may be arguing that precision air power is not stronger today than in World War II. It's just simply the case that everybody in the air power debate today believes that precision air power is more effective. The key question in the debate is how does that more accurate air power help you to win wars? There is essentially two schools of thought. The first school is the leadership targeting school, that greater accuracy means you can go for the head of the snake because you can put a bomb or a number of bombs right on top of the heads of enemy leaders and essentially winning the war very quickly, very smoothly. There's a second school of thought which says that the real precision revolution is not in going after the ability to go after leaders, because after all, you could do that, if not with one bomb, certainly with massed bombing before the age of precision. What's new about the age of precision is to go after truly point targets on against in enemy armies, to be able to hit tanks, to be able to hit tactical command posts, to be able to hit bridges, to be able to hit the infrastructure that the army itself is using on the battlefield. And that's what's new, and that's what allows air power and ground power together to be used like a hammer and anvil to smash enemy forces out in the open.
John Mearsheimer, if I may put to you, Donald Rumsfeld would seem to point to a third element in precision bombing, which is what he describes as humane bombing, but that is, I guess, being able to bomb without enormous civilian casualties. In today's media-saturated world where everything is filmed, is that as important as anything else here? And is it for real?
Well, it is for real. I mean, the important point to remember is that in the famous bombing campaigns of the past, and here we're talking about the American bombing of Germany and the American bombing of Japan in World War II, the United States killed massive numbers of civilians. Concepts like carpet bombing were introduced into the lexicon at that point in time. Firebombing in Tokyo, exactly. And that campaign, of course, culminated in the dropping of nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So in those days, strategic bombing was associated very clearly with massive punishment being inflicted on the opponent's civilian population. That is clearly not the case today, as Bob was pointing out. What we're talking about is going in, and in a rather surgical way, attacking command and control targets in Baghdad and in the surrounding areas.
So as strange as the juxtaposition of bombing and humanity sounds to our ear, you're willing to give that some credence?
Oh, there's no question. There's no question that there's an element of truth in what he has to say. But there's two problems with it. Number one, it's not likely to work. If it did not work in 1991, it's not likely to work this time. And I could explain in a minute why command and control is not that important to Saddam. But the second point is, I think when Al Jazeera and CNN film these bombing results, it's not going to appear to your average viewer as if the United States is being anywhere near as discriminate as Donald Rumsfeld claims we're being.
It doesn't look discriminating, even if it is, you're saying.
That's correct. And I think the United States would have been smart to hold off on the bombing campaign, the shock and awe campaign. In fact, I think the United States would have been smart not to use that kind of rhetoric, shock and awe. It's kind of offensive. It's going to bother people in the Arab and Islamic world.
And yet we know they used it in part to try and shake loose the Iraqi leadership without having to go to war. And we were told in the last 48 hours that they were holding back in hopes that would happen.
They used that rhetoric because it fits very well with their image of international politics.
Well,
these are people who basically believe in big stick diplomacy. They basically believe that if you take the American military and you employ it massively and promptly, that adversaries will capitulate. They'll throw their hands up. They believe in sort of a tough guy approach to international politics. Sometimes that makes sense and sometimes it doesn't.
But as you say, the world is going to watch and draw its own conclusions. Mansoor is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Mansoor. You're on the air.
Thank you for receiving my call. That's an interesting program that you do have. I was in Iran during Iran and Iraq war. Actually, I went from Framingham to Iran. I was there for 6 years, and I saw the missiles from Iraq. Actually, the last 167 I have counted, because I sent my children and my wife to the neighboring town because of their fear. And I had to stay in Tehran because I used to have my own company. And
so when you see these images today in Baghdad, Mansoor, does it bring back the fear that you felt in that circumstance?
Especially those people, they are not that much educated, or they don't have some kind of cannot overcome their fear, they are going to break, to have a breakdown. And I have seen in Iran a lot of elderly people, young children, they couldn't come there to themselves. I don't know what the word to use in this psychiatry a psychology term.
But the bombing just put them out of their minds.
Yes, and a lot of people, they left the city, and the economy actually collapsed because a lot of people, they couldn't do their day-by-day job. And
Monsieur, we've got I want to put that into our conversation here, and I thank you so much for your observation. Here's firsthand experience of that kind, of the impact and the images. That's such a Rubik's Cube here of, on the one hand, wanting to minimize U.S. casualties, want to do this thing fast as we can. On the other hand, victory is a complex issue, as John Mearsheimer and Robert Pape point out. I want to turn now to Ontario, Canada, where Yanar Mohammed joins us. He's a Canadian Iraqi who lived through the bombing of Baghdad during the 1991 Gulf War. Good evening and welcome, Yanar Mohammed.
Hello, Tom.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a she. Excuse me. I didn't recognize that. I apologize. You know, you were there in Baghdad in 91. How close were you to falling bombs? How much of an impact did it make on you, an impression? And what were your thoughts as you no doubt watched the new campaign on television today?
Well, for the first question, how close I was to the bombing, you may know that the way Baghdad has been planned, all the military facilities are dispersed all over the city. So
woven in among civilian areas, you mean?
Among civilian areas.
And deliberately so.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like it's a secluded area. There may be one or two of them that are in their own secluded areas, mm-hmm. but most of them are within residential areas. Mm-hmm. I remember the first night when they targeted the telecommunications building, it was quite close to my house. And to tell you the truth, that first night, I never believed that this could happen to us Iraqis.
What did it feel like to be in your home on that night?
Well, my feelings before the bombing were that this is the civilized world. This is the Western world who gives importance to human rights, who will take care of us. And the only oppressor, suppressor in the world is Saddam. But I had no idea. I was so naive. You know, that first night I was shaking. I just grabbed for my son of 2-year-old. We went to the safest corner of the house, and we were hiding between brick walls where we thought maybe the bombing, the missiles or the bullets cannot reach to us. My husband joined us, and he was in bad shape. I've never seen him like this all my life.
Did it change your attitude then? You're saying that it did, that it kind of equalized things that we don't want to see equalized or think of as equal, that is Saddam and the U.S.
Saddam was very bad to us, but the terrorism we've seen from the U.S. military machine was something incomprehensible.
You know, Mohammed, stand by. I want to put this to Robert Pape because, you know, of course, this is a parallel we don't want to draw, and we don't. Yet, you've written about the impact that bombing has on civilian populations, how we anticipate that it will break spirits, but sometimes it actually builds resolve, or as John Mearsheimer describes or fears, may turn populations against the bomber, even if the bomber is there in a cause for good?
Well, what you've just heard in your with your two guests is exactly the pattern that you see over almost every serious air campaign since World War One. That is, from World War One all the way through today, mm-hmm. which is that the populations, the people who were immediately under the air attack, especially the civilians, well, they are in shock and they are in fear. And for people who were in Manhattan, by the way, during 9/11, this also happened to them.
Yes, we saw it day after day after day.
But you also saw that does not translate, that shock and fear in the civilians, to paralysis on the part of the actual leaders. You'll recall that Churchill, under the Blitz, was a terrific leader. And everybody, of course, will remember in 9/11, Giuliani and Rumsfeld himself demonstrating amazing leadership under those particular circumstances.
So populations and leaders can actually rally. But can they rally, John Mearsheimer, under this kind of intensity? Or can it, as Donald Rumsfeld suggests, shock populations, leaders into submission?
Well, there's no question that there's not going to be a population uprising in Baghdad. That's not the aim of the campaign, and that's not going to happen. People may suffer significant collateral damage. They may be horrified, but they're not going to overthrow the regime. It is possible that the Republican Guard will overthrow the regime because it understands that the end is coming. And it's sometimes possible that leaders will quit because of a bombing campaign. But I don't think that's going to happen here, in large part because Saddam knows he's going to die. He has nothing to lose at this point in time. So I think our best hope now is to get the Republican Guards and the army to overthrow him and cut a deal with us.
Yanar Mohammed, let me just put to you there in Ontario, Canada, as you watch this today, you're not happy to see Saddam Hussein sitting there.
No,
so,
of course not.
So what are you thinking? Should the U.S. have held off on the bombing, put more American troops potentially into harm's way? I mean, that's asking a lot also, isn't it?
Of course. I'm totally against this war, Tom. I have to make that clear that whatever the political goal is, Saddam is the worst dictator. We admit that. But we are not willing to give away 500,000 casualties for that. And from my experience...
Do you really expect 500,000 casualties here?
Do you really believe what you hear now, that there are only 14 casualties?
Well, at this point, I have no idea. I hope it's few, but of course, we don't know.
I'll give you one example here. When they suspected that Saddam was in the Amiriya shelter, their satellites showed them that 450 women and children were in that shelter, but only because they thought that Saddam was under that shelter in the lower level, they were willing to kill 450 women and children, and we had to smell their flesh burning for 2 weeks.
If we knew that they were there, of course, there was denial that they did, but Yanar Mohammed, you paint a vivid picture of what it was like then, and we understand your perspective now. I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
I just have one addition, Tom.
Yes.
When I was there in Baghdad, hiding in the basement, listening to the radios, there was uprising that happened in the suburbs, in addition to the uprising that happened in the north and the south.
Uprising against?
Against Saddam. So I do not believe the story that Iraqi people are submissive and that they cannot go against their own government in the center, that is in Baghdad. It happened, it was stopped at some point, and of course the uprising was not supported by the American airplanes or the American officials in any way. They went against us, and that's the full story.
So you would rather have just waited. Yanar Mohammed in Ontario, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, John.
Can I make a quick point?
Is this John?
Yes,
John Mearsheimer.
Can I make a quick point?
Please.
First of all, I think in not using bombing and using the troops to march up to Baghdad, we're not really putting troops in harm's way. It's basically a cakewalk coming up from the south to Baghdad. The real question is what happens once you get to Baghdad. And if there are going to be significant casualties in this war, it's going to revolve around the fighting over Baghdad, assuming there is a fight for Baghdad. And the trade-off that the United States is going to face is that if it has to go into Baghdad with its military, there'll be a lot of American military casualties. The alternative is, in effect, to step back and pound the place with artillery and air power and kill not only the Iraqi defenders, but lots of Iraqi civilians. And I think if the United States has to go into Baghdad and faces that trade-off between American soldiers dying and Iraqi civilians and soldiers dying, that Iraqi civilians and soldiers will die in large numbers.
Robert Pape, John Mearsheimer is painting this as a kind of just a big gesture to brandish the big stick, kind of part and parcel of big stick diplomacy. Do you buy that?
Well, what I think is, you mean shock and awe as
yes,
brandishing the big... I think that it's a hope. I think that the people, I think Rumsfeld and many of his advisors are truly overconfident in what air power can produce. I think that there are many people in the Pentagon, not just in the military, but civilians, who have extreme faith in leadership targeting, that is, the ability of precision air power to win wars by attacking leaders, despite the fact that we've tried this strategy numerous times over the last 15 years, and it's failed or backfired each time.
Well, the ground troops are on the way this time. We're talking this hour about war from the skies, what works, what doesn't, and how history might inform this war in Iraq. Is there an element of pure theater in the airstrikes? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about war from the skies, about what works, what doesn't, and how history might inform this war in Iraq. You can join the conversation. Is there an element of grandstanding in airstrikes? Is it to win fast, to intimidate the enemy, or in the instant media age, to light up eyeballs at home and abroad with the image of American might? Or is this just the necessary, just the ticket that we saw in Baghdad today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests from the University of Chicago, Robert Pape and John Mearsheimer. You're welcome to join us as well. Lisa is calling from Jacksonville, North Carolina. Hi, Lisa. Welcome.
Hi. How are you this
evening? Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for taking my call.
What's on your mind, Lisa?
Well, I have a question that's been weighing on my mind, especially the last few days watching all the media coverage. Do you think that some of the intense media coverage is creating an atmosphere of negativity here back in the States for our troops that are overseas?
In what sense? We've seen all kinds of coverage and heard a lot. We've seen the convoys going into Iraq.
I'm thinking more along, like today, you know, I'm sitting there at work and there's the bombing on TV right there in front of me. Back, you know, in the day when the Marines took Iwo Jima and we had the other massive, you know, campaigns going on, it was like as a need-to-know basis. It seems like the American people are almost overloaded with information.
And so all the images of the military might and of the huge explosions today, you are concerned might create a negative image of the mission of U.S. troops.
Right.
Robert Pape, how about that?
I don't think that's actually true, and if anything, I think the coverage is probably boosting morale. And you see that the American military, especially the Army, has gone to great lengths to embed American journalists right in the actual fighting units to actually enhance and increase the coverage of what those units are doing on an almost hour-to-hour and then sometimes, as I was watching, minute-by-minute basis in real time.
In the fashion that's been done so far, it seems to me it's almost having the effect of increasing sympathy with these young men and some women who are in harm's way and generally
what I would say is that it is true that that your caller may have a point in the future, because we haven't yet seen how the coverage will change if and when there are serious casualties to U.S. forces. At the moment, what you're seeing is essentially what we've all come to hope and expect from our forces, which is highly trained, very dedicated individuals going right about their business with extreme purpose. Well, so far, very, very few have actually died. We hope that continues. But the fact is, what we haven't seen is the response to broad coverage. If it were to turn out to be, there would be some grisly events.
John Mearsheimer, how about it? We're early days here. Is this the part of the war where the society's elite come out from Washington and watch Bull Run from their wagons and end up horrified? I mean, I've stood on the beaches in Iwo Jima and heard the detailed stories of the gruesome fighting there. Presumably, we're not going to be allowed to see that, but we are allowed to see fireballs over Baghdad.
But again, Tom, this is not going to be Iwo Jima. This is not going to be the Eastern Front or the Normandy beachheads in World War II. This is Bambi versus Godzilla.
So you think the imagery, if you're looking at it from an image point of view, and we know the Pentagon does that, among other things, do you think they've got the right signal going out?
Well, I mean, there is something of a media circus here, right, with all the coverage and these journalists sort of out there acting like they're great combat warriors and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
I mean, there is an element of that. But I don't think this is going to undermine the effort in any meaningful way. The fact of the matter is this war is going to be over quite quickly. This is not a serious opponent. It could give us a bit of trouble in Baghdad if we have to fight our way in. It's not clear that's going to happen, but the United States is not going to suffer many casualties. The reason we're fighting this war is because it's not a fair fight. If it was a fair fight, we wouldn't be picking a war with Iraq. So I just don't foresee any of these significant problems that people allude to regarding the media.
Tim is calling from Pepperell, Massachusetts. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think the Bambi Godzilla analogy is a bit off the wall, mostly because if it's Bambi versus Godzilla, which in some respects may be a good correlation or analogy of the situation, Bambi's still trying to kill Godzilla. So anything that the United States military does to, and I'm sure they're trying to minimize casualties on the Iraqi side, but anything that they can do that's going to protect one more American life, quite frankly, I'm not concerned whether it looks good to the rest of the world. There's some simple objectives in war, and that they're trying to meet them. They're trying to meet them quickly. And unfortunately, if people on the other side some more of them die than needed to, I think that blame needs to be simply pointed at Saddam Hussein, who really has no humanity for his own people.
Tim, let me just ask you on that front. I mean, I understand where you're coming from. At the same time, John Mearsheimer is pointing to a world that's all woven together by media, where everything gets witnessed, where every action has a spillover effect beyond the immediate effects of the war. Are you prepared to consider those in the equation, or, you know, devil take the hindmost?
Well, I think certainly you factor those into the equation. But quite frankly, you don't factor those into the equation before protecting your own military's lives.
Mm-hmm.
So war isn't good. It doesn't look good.
Yep.
And if you spend time trying to make it look good, you're probably going to do more damage than you would if you simply stick to what your objectives are, get it completed as quickly as possible. So this analogy of well, Bambi, and somehow it's not a fair. Bambi's still trying to kill you, number one, and Bambi can kill people, and to try to worry about whether it looks good or not. Well, yeah, you know, that's a whole conversation in and of itself.
Tim, we've got it. My time's running down. Let me put that to John Mearsheimer. Here's a big pushback against the Bambi Godzilla idea and the notion, and you kind of associate it with Donald Rumsfeld, we'll do whatever it takes to protect American lives and get this straightforward mission taken care of ASAP.
Well, look, I was not talking about sacrificing American lives. My point is, if
you don't think it's going to be necessary.
Well, it may be necessary, but wait until the last moment to use the shock and awe campaign.
Mm-hmm.
The ground war is going fine, and stick with the ground war for the time being. The point that I would make to the caller is that you want to remember Clausewitz's famous dictum that war is an extension of politics by other means. We're not simply concerned with the military dimension of this fight. We're concerned with the long-term political consequences as well. And we're going to own Iraq after this war, and we're going to be deeply involved, more deeply than ever, in the Middle East.
Let me go to Robert Pape in the few seconds we have left. Robert Pape, how would you tweak the balance of air and ground then? Would you lay off at this point, or what would you do?
What I think is that heavy use of shock and awe, and certainly continuing to hit Baghdad with 1,000 sorties every day instead of actually mounting a ground offensive, is likely to first make this longer, not shorter. This will not shorten the campaign. And second, it's possible it will provoke a backlash, either from Saddam with whatever chemical weapons he has, or in the Arab world.
You have both given us a lot to think about tonight, and I thank you very much for joining us at the University of Chicago, John Mearsheimer, author of The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
And Robert Pape, author of Wars Can't Be Won Only From Above in today's New York Times and Bombing to Win, Air Power and Coercion in War. Thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, glad to be here.
For ongoing coverage of war with Iraq, including detailed maps of the region, go to our website, onpointradio.org. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
What will follow will not be a repeat of any other conflict. It will be of a force and scope and scale that has been beyond what has been seen before.
You will be victorious, Iraqi people, and the sons of your nation will be victorious as well, and God's willing, victory will be on your side. Your enemies will go to hell and will be shamed.
The servicemen who were killed in the helicopter crash overnight, they were part of our efforts to take the Al-Faw Peninsula in the south of Iraq when this tragedy occurred. It underlines the dangers facing our forces as they carry out their mission to bring down Saddam Hussein's regime and disarm Iraq of weapons of mass destruction.
We're from Secretary Powell, who briefed us on the ever-growing coalition of the willing
nations who support our deep desire for peace and freedom. Over 40 nations now support our efforts.
Let us not dwell on the divisions of the past. Let us confront the realities of the present, however harsh, and look for ways to forge stronger unity in the future.
So now, within the last hour, coalition forces have launched a massive air campaign throughout Iraq. Several hundred military targets will be hit over the coming hours.
And there, an extraordinary week. President Bush announces to the nation that war on Iraq has begun. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld promises the scale of force used in Iraq will be beyond what has been seen before. After the opening attack, Saddam Hussein, or one of his doubles, promises victory on Iraqi TV. British Prime Minister Tony Blair expresses regret over the first coalition casualties of war. 8 British and 4 American soldiers died in a Marine helicopter crash that is being called an accident. 2 more U.S. Marines died today. President Bush says over 40 nations have now signed on in support of the U.S.-led invasion. And with the United Nations deeply divided, Secretary General Kofi Annan says it is time to accept the reality of war and find a way to move forward. Finally, General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, announcing today's massive air attack on Baghdad. Jack Beatty, just 1 week, in fact, just days, and we are well into this war.
Yes, and I think maybe a historic week. I mean, I have a feeling that we've started something here that our children are going to be living with and their children. You know, all through our conversations with people this week, we kept hearing a leitmotif, and it's been that you know, we were afraid that if we did shock and awe of what that would do. We were afraid of our power in a battle of Baghdad. In other words, we were afraid of our own power in this war, and I think that's a paradigm, really, for the country today. We have no rival in the world. We really have to be afraid of ourselves. We have to be afraid of our power. And we have to be especially afraid of our power joined to our inveterate idealism and to the blindness that has historically given us to our own faults and to our place in the world.
But Jack, that view you're expressing is just the very opposite of what we hear from the White House. I mean, you know, where they want to put exactly that power in the pursuit of those ideals and embrace it high and proud.
Yes, I suppose I'm influenced by having seen The Quiet American last night, Graham Greene's film adaptation of Graham Greene's movie, and there you have a young man, Pyle, in Vietnam, French Vietnam, who wants to do good, says the narrator, not just for the people, but for the world, and of course who winds up killing through intermediaries on any number of civilians, and of course we wound up taking over the war. It's precisely this connection between virtue and between power and virtue that is the theme of what? Greek tragedy from all time, and that has cracked many nations in the past. When nations overreach, when they think that their powers are sort of vested by God, and I think we have a leader who believes that about America and believes that in some sense he's been picked by God to lead us in this moment. And that frightens me. And I think it should frighten the world, and it does. You know, polls are reading flat-out statement today's Financial Times. The world is more afraid of George W. Bush than it is of Saddam Hussein.
And yet, you can feel the honestly held sentiment that there's trouble in the world, and because of its power, it's the United States' duty to go out and face it.
Yes, and we haven't done a great job with that, have we, if you look at our interventions around the world. I mean, yes, in the wars where we had to participate in, World War II and Korea, but our optional wars, show me the results that they have brought. I mean, other than the 2 humanitarian interventions in the Balkans, and those were late, I don't see much there that we have done that hasn't been a source of misery for years upon years for other people.
We must,
you know,
I guess, at this...
I'm sorry?
Oh, just we're running out of time, but I guess at this point we must hope that this one goes better. But we hear the history that you're citing, Jack, and thank you for joining us tonight with it.
All right. Well, thank you.
On Point senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.